Hey, it's Don Coscarelli, filmmaker. I just wrote a book. Check it out. It's called Fiction, Tales from the World of Phantasm. And it can teach you all the things that you never knew about the Phantasm film series. A lot of interesting stuff. Horror, violence, not much sex. Check it out. Now available on Amazon, paperback, and Kindle.
This is The Gala Show. I'm your reporter on the beat, Gala Avery. On this episode, you may know my guest as the co-founder of Three Monkeys Theater Company from his BBC documentaries and radio programs, or perhaps as a director of one of your favorite episodes from one of these popular shows, such as Hannibal, Daredevil, Luke Cage, The Punisher, The Runaways, Berlin Station, Tin Star, and The Witcher. But here on The Gala Show, I know him as the man who made sure that the pilot episodes to my brother's favorite manga, One Piece, were faithfully adapted into a live-action version, Mark Yobst. Hi, Mark.
Hey. Nice to see you.
It's nice to see you, too. I'm getting, like, big sister points today, to be honest.
That's so cool.
I know. I was so excited. So before we bring up the topic for today, I have a question for you. Actually, this question does come from my little brother, Ever, who is a lifelong fan of One Piece.
You should have brought him.
I know, I should have. So for those of you that don't know, because I talk about my brother a little bit, he's a huge fan of One Piece. He and I both grew up watching anime together, and he's actually been supporting One Piece weekly since 2006. He's been reading it every week. He reads it in three different ways, like the scans.
Tough audience.
He's a tough audience, but he loved the live action show.
Amazing.
So much. I was really nervous because when the Cowboy Bebop show came out, I knew people that loved Cowboy Bebop, and they rejected it and repelled it. And so when One Piece came out, I was like, oh, I hope it's good.
No,
I hope my brother loves it.
The thing
it.
Is, One Piece means so much to so many different people, not just as a great show, but actually as, you know, something that's... So many people came in and would say that it's seen them through some dark times.
Yeah, I agree. I think my brother is one of those people that, like, it was... No matter what was going on in his life, he always had One Piece.
Yeah.
And so when I told him that I was talking to you, I was like, I got to ask him if he has any questions. So he actually did have one. So he wanted to know, my brother Ever, did any of Luffy's leadership qualities transfer over to how the production of the live action show was run?
Great question. What's his name?
Ever.
Hey, Ever. Such a great question, man. Yes, I would say so. I would say that what we were looking for when we were casting Luffy is a young actor who wasn't playing that part. Because sometimes if somebody plays a kind of optimistic, upbeat character, it can get wearing after a while and be a bit irritable. And when we found Iñaki in Mexico... to play the part, and he auditioned for the part. In his audition, he did something off script that just made us all laugh straight away. And we thought, he's an interesting guy. So we brought him back and we did another session and I worked with him a little bit. When he came out to South Africa and we started working with him, his spirit, his heart permeated everybody in the crew. There's no doubt that he was number one on the call sheet. His way of being relaxed everybody, made everybody feel good, and there's no doubt that that led a lot of the tone with which we were able to shoot the show.
Now, as always, my guest gets to bring their topic to the mic. Mark, why don't you tell us what your topic is and why you decided to choose it?
Well, I wanted to talk about passion projects because I think... when somebody can really find a space to express their passion, you get an authenticity of work which is really unique and special. And you can do it in your own projects, you know, just the stuff that you work on your own, or you collaborate with kind of various people that you whose ideas you like. But I think you can actually do it also when you're working on more mainstream shows, you know, studio shows and all the rest of it. And it's something which I think is really important to... remember to bring yourself and your individuality into whatever it is that you're doing, because that's what makes a project unique. And to a degree, that's how I always go about choosing my projects. You know, there are plenty of scripts that you get sent, you read, you look at them, you think, yeah, they're great, I like it, but what can I bring as an individual to this show that nobody else could? Or is it a show where actually, you know, any director could come along and come in and do the show and do a brilliant job, but there's nothing particular that I, as my individual personality, can bring to it? So that's what you look for. And I think passion projects, there are some amazing passion projects that people have made that change the dial of filmmaking, change the lens with which you can look at subjects and people and characters and situations. And that's what really, really excites me. And we do these passion projects for our soul, and you've got to keep feeding your soul, because otherwise after a while you get a little bit tired by the whole thing. So it's really important to me that we never forget where our passion led us. But first, time for a commercial break.
I might be vegetarian, but that doesn't mean I can't enjoy a good spice rub. My favorite place to get them is Smoked Bros, a veteran-owned and operated business that sells premium handcrafted dry rubs, spice blends, and seasonings. Psst, guys, you can even put it on your popcorn. My favorites are Honey Badger, because he doesn't give a bleep, and jelly and peanut flavor topping, because some things just taste better together. The website even has recipes, so go check out smokedbros.com to support a veteran-owned and operated business and fill your cabinet with delicious flavor.
And we're back.
You heard it here. We are going to be talking about passion projects. I'm putting 30 minutes on the clock and our time starts now. So my brother actually had a second question, which I thought he didn't know what your topic was, but I think it ties in really nicely because he always talks to me about how One Piece is about dreams and how Luffy is a dreamer. And he wanted me to ask you, what is your dream?
Oh,
which I think tied in really well with passion projects.
That's so interesting. I have so many dreams. I still have so many dreams. Do you mean particularly in the kind of the creative world or anything?
Well, I think as a creative, we're probably living our dreams right now. As it's like an active dream. But I was going to ask you, because it kind of ties in, like, I know every person that has passion projects has that one they're chasing. Like my dad has his one that I'm named after, his Gala Dali project that he's been working on since before I was born. Yeah. And like, he's been chasing that dream. Yeah. So I'm sure like you have several passion projects.
Oh, I do. Yeah. Great. Thank you, Eva. Hey, again, salute to Eva. I am working at the moment, and have been for the last maybe 6-7 years, on a project that is all about home.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that we have, that this longing for a sense of home, to come home, a place where we can just be ourselves and relax and breathe and express ourselves safely. And where is home? What is home? Who is home to us? And so I started working with some young people in the southwest of England, where I live in Bristol, who are going to a community centre. They've been ejected from their homes by their mums, their dads, by their mums and dads, by the family, or they've run away, or there's been some terrible family breakdown. And so I spend quite a lot of time hanging out with them, making cups of tea with them in the community centre kitchen. They're noisy, they're naughty, they're cheeky, they're funny.
That's why they've been kicked out.
Yeah, well, maybe that's why they get kicked out. But maybe we should kind of find space in our lives for that, because I think
it's an important thing to have.
It is. And sometimes, you know, life can kind of grind that down. And that, in a way, is the passion. Sometimes that energy, that life, that even when you're pushing against something, is the passion. And what we need to do in our world is channel that, find a way to not reject it or try and tame it, but actually go with it. And out of that comes the most extraordinary things. And so one day I was working with these kids. They're homeless. It's for an organization called 1625 Independent People. They work with 16 to 25-year-olds. And anybody can come in through that door and they'll find a place and they'll find a home.
That's so wonderful.
It is so wonderful. And the people who work there are just the most amazing people, because they genuinely want these people to find the thing that will allow them to be themselves. I was making cups of tea with these kids, and next to me was sitting this young black boy, 17 years old, shy as they come, tall, skinny. And as we were, everybody else was being noisy and he was being really quiet, I noticed that on the back of his hand he had RIP tattooed. And it was really raw. It would look like it'd been done that morning. So I said to him, would you mind telling me why you had that tattooed on the back of your hand? And he told me the story about how his best mate had been stabbed and killed 2 days before.
Wow, that's so... Oh, God, and he's here dealing with it.
Yeah, there he was dealing with it. And the way he dealt with it was this. RIP on the back of his hand. But here's the thing. He didn't tell me that story as I'm telling you the story now.
Mm-hmm.
He got up and he started to rap that story.
Wow.
And he rhymed the story. And then he got up and he started to move it. And it was like... this shy boy just became a completely different person, and he started to dance the story of how his friend had been stabbed and killed. And I drove away that night thinking, isn't it interesting how we always turn the camera onto the knife crime in our business? The first thing we talk about is what happened, how did it happen, why did it happen, the killer, all that kind of stuff. We know how to do that. It becomes a crime drama or a thriller or whatever it is, you know. But what about this boy in front of me dancing and rhyming the story of this? Why don't we ever see that on our screens?
They also say, like the psychology of news, basically you're never supposed to say who the killer is or publicize the killer because it creates more crimes exactly like it. You're supposed to publicize who the victims are,
right,
and their stories. And right, I think that just like in the film industry, our news cycle has, yeah, also kind of swapped to like, let's make it really crazy. Like, let's focus like on these people who did these crazy things,
yeah,
instead of like the personal stories of like who lost people.
Yes. Or... and it's a moment in their life. It's not the entire, in the entirety of their lives. And so, you know, yes, there's a stabbing that take place, but there's more to that person's life than just that incident. It will have changed their lives for sure. But what we don't do in our filmmaking and our narrative storytelling is tell the side to these people's lives that I was witnessing in this community center in the kitchen. Loud, naughty, funny, you know, warm-hearted, full of life, full of lyricism. But when I said to them, what should I make a film about? They said, can you make a film about our lives that my mum and my grandma will go and see?
Wow, because they want like a what shows them in their best light.
Yeah.
Yeah,
or not necessarily just, you know, not necessarily just the best light, but
the truth,
but the
maybe.
Nuance. Yeah,
the
yeah,
way the their mom and grandma would know them. Yeah.
So I put those things together and started to create this movie that uses beatbox and rap and rhyme and dance as a way of expressing their lives.
That's so cool. It's like a musical, basically.
It's kind of like a musical, but it's not like a West Side Story musical. It's a much more street musical.
Yeah.
And we're working with an organization called Bird Gang, who are a really cool dance outfit who use movement to tell story. And then I'm working with Conrad Murray, who is the director of the Beatbox Academy in London, an extraordinary lyricist and director and artist in his own right. And then workshopping it with young people at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre Company and all those different places where we can really test the script out so the voices are authentic and coming from the young people.
And have chemistry.
And have chemistry. Yeah, absolutely. You've got to have chemistry for something like this. So the story revolves around this young 17-year-old boy, Noah, who's African-Caribbean background, lives in Birmingham. These are all based on true stories, by the way. Forced to fingerprint the handle of a knife that was used in a stabbing that he didn't do.
Wow.
But the guy who did the stabbing already had a record,
so
he'd get 20 years.
So he took the fall.
So he took the fall, and then he would... increase his position within the gang.
Yeah, move up in the gang.
Yeah. But Noah didn't want to do that. He didn't want a gang life. So the only way he can get away from it is to run away. And he runs away into Bristol and he ends up on the streets in Bristol. Minnie is a 16-year-old girl who is used by her dad and stepmother as a cash cow. In other words, they say to social services she's got ADHD to get money.
To get the money.
She doesn't have ADHD.
No.
So she doesn't want to be held back by this label. So she runs away, and she runs away to her Nana Mary, who lives in a home, who she feels at home with. She's old, she doesn't have to prove herself anymore, and they just kind of, they hold hands, you know, the old hand
of a
and
nice
the young
life,
hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she can't stay there, so she ends up on the streets of Bristol. And the narrator of the film, the person who leads us through this, who talks to the camera as a friend taking him through this life, is Fizzy, And Fizzy's 13 years old. His mom uses the apartment for paying guests at nighttime, men. Mm-hmm. So he has to leave the apartment. He ends up on the streets. He gets into the wrong people and he rents himself out.
Wow.
True stories. All these are true stories.
And they're heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Because it's children. It's children.
But here's the thing. In this film, Home, my passion project, they don't present with all that darkness. Because that's not my experience of being with these people. I don't want to define them by that. By their backstories.
By the one moment in their life.
By the one moment in their life. Absolutely right. They don't define themselves that way. They don't present to you in the kitchen with all this dark baggage in front of them and, oh, life's so terrible. They present with laughter and joy and fun and playfulness. So yeah, I don't want to define them by their difficulties, nor do I want to deny those difficulties. But you want to enjoy the energy of who they are and how they are. And Fizzy is kind of, it's a bit like an Artful Dodger. You know, the guys that I met like this, they are like that. They kind of push you away a little bit with their humor and their joy. But they use the rap, they use the rhyme, they use the dance as a way of distancing the pain of what goes on. To express themselves. It's too painful to express it in the way that we're talking now.
Verbally, yeah.
So that gives us license in the film when you get those emotional moments to move into a bit of dance or to move into a little bit of rhyme.
I love that.
And that's authentic. You know?
It is. It's exactly what you saw in the kitchen that day.
Yes. And what I'm really trying to do is just play that truth and change the dial of storytelling of these young people so that we capture them in a different kind of a way. We don't deny the difficulties of their lives, but we're not defining them by those difficulties.
So when you bring up the word home, when I was reading your biography, I was really interested. So you were born in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
And then how old were you when you moved to London?
2.
So you were 2 years old, but you're born in Zimbabwe, moved to London. Your dad was a farmer or an agricultural?
Cowboy. He's a cowboy.
Of course, like my favorite, my absolute favorite. And your mom was an artist.
That's right.
And you studied agriculture in school.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like I was like looking at this.
Such a natural route into filmmaking.
Well, I loved it because I was thinking you're kind of caught between these two worlds. Like you have like the salt of the earth and then you have the arts and you managed to study agriculture. And then also you studied, what was it? The Royal Shakespeare Company while you were in college. So you really had like these two worlds.
Yeah.
Does farming play like a role in here? I had to ask. I was like, does the physicality, because I know you acted.
Yeah.
So like the physicality of farming and like what is home to you? You have like this background in Zimbabwe, you're in London, you're a farmer, you're an actor.
And also my mom, you know, comes from a Jewish family and so they had to leave Vienna during the war and so they became refugees and her family.
What is home for her and what is home for you?
And it's interesting you ask that question because, you know, as a child, one of the things that I remember very much coming to England with a name like Jobst, and my parents both, my father was German, and they had to get out of Germany. They not because they were Jewish, but they were sort of bohemians, really. You know, he was a gold and silver smith, and my grandmother was followed Isadora Duncan and all that,
of wild stuff. Ken Russell did an excellent BBC on her.
Yeah, it was really good, wasn't
that's
it?
That's one
you
of
know,
my favorite.
It was so shocking.
That's one of my favorite BBC docs that he did.
Oh, I'm amazed you've seen that.
Yeah, I'm
a
huge Ken Russell fan.
Well,
so
yeah. Well, so they had to get out of Germany, but my mom had to get out of Germany because she was Jewish and handed out.
Did they know each other before?
No. They met in England. But I remember as a child that kind of sense of always that it's a subconscious thing, but always your bags had to be packed. You kind of always needed to know where your passport was and where your birth certificate.
It's like, well,
ready to go.
You kind of have that same thing then, because like, what is home? Where is your heart?
Maybe that's what's the thing that's, you know, propelling this passion project. The fact that I'm searching for home in some form.
Yeah, and also it ties you to, even though it might not seem like you have a lot in common with these kids, you actually do because you have this same searching of like, where is my home and like, what am I doing?
And the interesting thing is, you know, Gala, that the more people I talk to about it, and here I am in LA, you know, trying to close the finance to make the film on a low budget because it needs to be what it is. I don't want it to be compromised. There are so many people for whom this notion of what is home? Where do we feel home? Where do we feel that sense of, you know, I did a sleep out recently to raise money for this organization I've been working with. And I slept out with a whole bunch of people out on the streets in Bristol. And one of the guys that was there is a young chap called Israel, who I've known for maybe 3 or 4 years now, working in this place. And he's called Israel. And he's a lovely lad. He's got a young girl and he's really trying to kind of write his life. And one time in the evening, I said to him, Israel, what does home mean for you? And he thought for a little bit and then he said, you know, home for me would be being able to lie in my bed in my room and not be afraid of the footsteps walking past my door.
Wow.
Now that's pretty basic, isn't it?
That is really basic. Yeah. Just not to feel afraid.
Yeah. And interestingly, if you zoom out from that and you think about what's happening in Ukraine, Ukraine is a home, let's just say his bedroom, the room, being invaded by Russia. How do they feel? Do they feel safe?
Anyone or Israel who has to flee, or Gaza? Yeah, anyone who has to flee or be afraid that someone, even like on a global scale, like a country, or even on like a just home scale, like if you're there's strange men walking in and out of your mother's room.
You're always
night,
on edge. Slightly.
You're always on edge. You always have your backs packed.
You know. And one of my jobs as a director is so, especially like for something like One Piece, you know, where you've got a young cast, is to create a safe space.
You're like the father of the crew.
Yeah.
And the cast. Yeah.
And so the set becomes their home. And my job is to make sure that they can walk onto that set and feel completely safe. Because if they don't, they'll be like Israel, they'll be tight.
Yeah, they can't do their job.
They can't do their job. So they'll restrain themselves. And the thing about Home, the movie, is one, it's very similar to One Piece in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, One Piece, it's not a dark homework film. It's very joyful, it's very colourful, it's very energized. If you think about One Piece, Luffy's backstory, abandoned by his mum.
It's very sad.
Well, he never knew. Yeah,
yeah, it's very,
you know,
sad.
He never knew his mum. He was abandoned by his dad. He was bullied by his grandfather. He's still optimistic and positive, just like Fizzy is. If you think about Nami, her backstory of the Kokuyashi village and the kind of the devastation and the death of Belmare and all of that, they all have dark stories, but they present in the world as different kinds of people. So that's the tone of Home. It's the same kind of thing. So you're not denying their situation, but you're not defining by them.
When you are brought in to direct an episode of a TV series or maybe something that's not exactly your passion project that you want to do, how do you inject your own passion into it to still make sure that it's a good project?
I think you have to find your true north to that story, to that film, to that episode. What I mean by that is, you know, what's this story about, actually? So you have an episode, for example, let's just take Daredevil.
Mm-hmm. Daredevil's the one that has that really amazing sequence in it, right?
The stairwell
sequence. The stairwell sequence?
That's right.
So I had a friend, when that first came out, actually send it to me on YouTube. I don't know why.
Really?
I never had seen Daredevil. And he's like, look at this sequence. And I was like,
that's so cool.
Okay, yeah. And then when I saw it again, I was like, oh my God, that's the sequence from Daredevil.
Wow, thank you. Yeah. Well, the thing about that episode is that it was a very theatrical, Mark Verheiden wrote it, really brilliant episode. There's a lot of anxiety from Marvel Studios and from Netflix about it because it was quite talky. It was basically just the Punisher and Daredevil who was chained to a chimney on the top of the rooftops of Manhattan having a ding-dong. Basically, and it's the first time the Punisher comes into the Daredevil.
Okay, wait, for us Americans, what's a ding-dong?
Oh, dear. A ding-dong? A ding-dong is like, you know, a powwow. It's they're sort of arguing with each other. Trying to work each other out. That's such a British... I didn't even realize I was saying it. I'm sorry.
I kind of knew what it was, but I was like, oh, God, other people might be like, what's a ding-dong?
No, don't go down the wrong road. A ding-dong isn't the wrong road. A ding-dong is a powwow. They're just having a little chat with each other. Anyway, it becomes a big argument. And for me, I get, you know, I suppose because I come from theatre and so I'm very used to working with actors and, you know, in theatre you only have a wide shot.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, that's all there is.
And there's no editing.
And so your job as a director is to kind of help the audience make their close-ups. But more importantly than that, to absolutely know how to work with actors and to be able to draw a performance out and to help them find out what their character is and why they're there. The questions you always ask are, what's the story? What do you as a character want? And what are the obstacles in the way for you getting what you want? That's drama.
Yeah.
You know. And so all the time, when you're working in theatre, all the time you're pushing that. You're saying to the actor, so what do you want now? What do you want out of the scene? Once you know what you want out of this scene, you have some real juice to work with, you know. So with that episode of Daredevil, let's say, you know, you ask your question about how do you bring yourself into it. Well, to me, my true north for that episode is Daredevil believes in redemption. The Punisher believes in revenge.
Mm-hmm.
So the true north of that whole episode is about which one wins out. Do we go with redemption, with a life of a redemptive life, or do you go through a life of revenge? And that suddenly gives you a real driving idea to focus the whole episode around. With One Piece, for example, you know, the big question you ask all the time is, you know, why are we doing this in live action? There's a fantastic manga, it's a great anime. What can we bring in live action that adds to that rather than tries to replicate it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we add, obviously, is three dimensions. It's the third dimension. It's two dimensions as a manga, it's two dimensions as an anime. And as live action, we add the third dimension, which is emotion and a backstory. So the big question is, what's the true north to One Piece? Because we've got this huge, great show that we're spending millions on. It's 8 hours of drama. How do we navigate our way around that so that we have some sense of focus and direction? Well, to me, my pitch was, and I don't know if this is Oda-san's view, but it's what I got from it, is that in 22 years of this thing having existed, they never find the treasure. They've never yet found the treasure.
Mm-hmm.
That's because the treasure's not out there.
It's in inside. Here. I love it. Some people might think it's corny, but that's just the truth.
It's kind of corny, but it's okay.
But it's okay to be corny.
It's truthful, too.
I think also, like, in today's day and age, we are very cynical.
Yeah.
And I think that's why One Piece hits for a lot of people, because it's okay to be corny. It's okay to have your dreams. It's okay to follow them. It's okay to forge ahead. I love it. And also
the whole driver then becomes about Luffy wanting to find a family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about found family. And he finds a family of people who enable him to fulfill his dream. And in the process, he can enable them to fulfill their dreams.
Yeah.
So that's about following your dreams. It's about believing in your friendships as family and being loyal to them.
Yeah.
So I felt like, I know it's corny, but hell, listen, we need to be telling stories right now. And I really, this is, you know, talk about passion projects. I really passionately believe this. We need to be telling stories that the world is in a dark place at the moment. It's really tricky to navigate our way through this. We need, as storytellers, to tell stories that lead us to hope, lead us into. And now that's very easy to be kind of, you know, cynical about that and say, yeah, but, you know, but that's our job.
I agree.
It's such a huge privilege we have to have this space to tell stories. And how you look at life is something that we can influence in the ways that we tell stories. And that's why I wanted to do One Piece. One Piece was a bit of a passion project for me.
Yeah, my brother said when he watched it, he could tell the people that made it really loved it and respected it. And he also said the way that the A stories and the B stories interweave with each other, he's like, yeah, you can just tell these people.
Way to go, Eva.
Yeah, he was just like, you can just tell. Like, these people love the show. And I was so relieved, honestly, when it came out. And I got it for him. I'm like, here. Well, here's One Piece. Like,
God.
I'm so nervous for you to watch
it.
I
bet he was nervous too.
He watched all of it in one sitting.
Wow.
Like, he literally just sat down. He like closed his door in his room. And then I started getting text messages like, oh my God. Oh my God, it's so good. Oh my God, we have to watch it together. Pleased. And it was so good.
The stakes are high, huh?
Well, the stakes are high, but also like, so my dad did the adaptation for Silent Hill. And man, those fans are
big. Yeah.
They're big and they're scary. Passionate. Like, my dad was getting death threats from the Silent Hill script, like, to his email box. I was like, oh, okay, really? Silent Hill's insane. But you've done, like, One Piece, and then also you worked on The Witcher.
Yeah.
And, like, you've worked on, obviously, like, Daredevil, Luke Cage, The Punisher. Like, you've done so many kind of these adaptations. How do you deal with the fans of those? Do you have any interaction with them at all?
Yes. Look, you're making it for the fans, and you want to please the fans. But what you can't do is try, you have to be authentic to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we're talking about passion projects, you've got to bring your passion into it. If you can't find the passion to do what it is that you're doing, it might be better for you to kind of pull away from it.
Well, I think it's really interesting what you said earlier, like, you have to find your North Star to it, because a lot of these projects are kind of, I'm going to put in air quotes, passion projects for the fans.
Yeah.
It's like, it's their passion. It's like their dream to see it adapted. Like, I would, and I say this very cautiously, I would love to have Berserk be adapted live action, but like in the style of Legend.
Yeah.
Like I would love like a traditional like pitch Berserk. I know I should. I should go pitch it. I'm like,
Here's the pitch.
Here's the pitch. Berserk as Legend. Because like I love the manga. I love the first iteration of the anime. Yeah. The second iteration of the anime. Yeah. I'm not gonna comment on that because someone might love it. I don't.
Yeah.
But I would love like a live action version of that. And if that started getting made, I'd be like, oh my God, I'm so excited.
Yeah.
But I'm so scared. Because I'm that fan. That's like it's my passion to see it.
Yeah. So the thing about it is what you can't do is try to second guess. You can't try to, you have to be authentic. In the same way with an actor, you know, it's really important to learn how to give notes to an actor, because if you're not very careful, they will try and do what they think you want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be inauthentic. And this is kind of, you know, a slightly geeky director thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, too often, you know, we give adjectives or adverbs to an actor. You know, could you be a bit angrier or could you be a bit sexier? Well, the actor doesn't really know how to play that. You know, so I thought I was being sexy. So now you've undermined them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So then they do what they think you think is sexy,
mm-hmm.
which will never be right. But if you can say something to them like, could you seduce her? You can play that.
A verb, yeah.
Yeah, it's a verb. So all those sort of things. And so it's a similar kind of thing when you come to these adaptations. To me, look, I'm not a comic book fan particularly. I'm not a massive manga or anime fan. And yet I seem to be doing all these kinds of things.
You seem to be also really good. But maybe it's because you have a little bit of distance from it. That you're not so deeply involved in it that your heart isn't like 100%, because my dad always tells the story, and I'll tell you afterwards the full story if you want, but he said it on the Video Archives podcast before about Kubrick buying a gun from John Milius, and how John Milius sold him like this like really rare gun, and then he got a phone call from Kubrick, and Kubrick had taken apart the entire gun and then like swapped out all the handles and all the things and put it back together, and John Milius was like, oh my God, you ruined it. And Kubrick was like, no, I made it better.
Wow.
And that's how he went for an adaptation. And so it's like, yeah, you can't be married to the material when you adapt something.
No, on one occasion I had a short film at a film festival with Anthony Minghella. And he and I had lunch together. And I was asking him, it's about the time of The Talented Mr. Ripley. And I talked to him about adaptation and how do you adapt a novel like The English Patient or mm-hmm. The Talented Mr. Ripley. And he said, well, what you do is you read the book and then you digest it. And you write from the flavor that's left in your mouth.
No, because manga is different than anime, is different than live action. Different. Even movies are different than plays.
Exactly.
Everything's different.
You've got to kind of somehow adapt it. And you've got to find your truth within it. And for me, my approach in these things, whether it's the Marvel Studios work or whether it's The Witcher or One Piece, is to always go with character.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came into The Witcher to bring it onto track, because it was not quite working, one of the first things I did was sit down with Henry to talk to him to say...
I have such a crush on Henry Cavill.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I love you, Henry.
And many, 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 many others.
I know, mean every woman that's listening right now.
Yeah, well, he's a handsome boy.
Yeah.
And what a body.
I love when he reloads his punches.
Oh my God, he works so hard and he's extraordinary. But one of the first things that we did was to sit down together and sort of say, so who is this guy? You know, why is he so silent and so gruff? And what is it that makes him so closed, do you think? And we went back to, well, he was, you know, abandoned by his parents. He's left. And then he was taken to Kaer Morhen. And then, you know, 8 out of 10 of those boys don't survive. They die. He was one of the two that survived. What does that do to a person? So you just come in at it with character, and then you start to kind of dimensionalize that part, and you take it away from the two dimensions that we see in the video games, and that starts to build a character that becomes somebody that the audience can relate to, because that's what we're trying to do all the time.
You know, I think you're really good at telling these superhero and video game stories because they're all about orphans who are honestly looking for their home. I think it's like that might be why you're really good at it.
Interesting.
I know, you're telling all these stories about
orphans. You're telling me too much about myself in this interview.
No, but honestly, you're telling all these stories about orphans. And so maybe these are the kinds of characters that you're drawn to. How long have you been working on Home for?
I've been working on Home probably for 7 years now.
Yeah.
In between, you know, going off and earning money and coming back and having a bit of time, put some money in the bank, get on back into it, you know. And we're just at the stage now of we have a full script. It's very exciting. It's being you know, that's the next thing I want to do. And I want to shoot it on, you know, on a very low budget, because it needs to be truthful to what it is.
Are you going to shoot it like on location, like in the neighborhood in England?
Yeah.
What neighborhood is it that you're going to shoot?
It's in Bristol. It's a beautiful city. It's a very cinematic city. And there's areas which are very old and cobbled streets and arches and all that kind of stuff. And there's some very contemporary places. And what happens with in the end of the story is the three of them meet and they form a kind of friendship. But Noah's gang and want to come and get him from Bristol because they know that he knows who actually did the stabbing. Minnie's family, because when she left the house, she took nicked a whole load of jewellery.
Mm-hmm.
They want the jewellery back. They meet in the centre of Bristol, the two of them. You know, Minnie's father sees that she's with Noah, who's a black man. And he says, that's not going to happen. They start this big fight in the centre of Bristol, which isn't a fight, it's a dance.
I can't wait to see this. This is exciting.
And they slip away. Noah and Minnie slip away. And they end up under the arches of this kind of huge, big, you know, motorway. And Noah says, well, maybe I've just got to go back home. To where I come from. Maybe that's the card that my life has been dealt. Maybe that's just something I've got to come to terms with. And Minnie says, no way.
Oh, she says no.
Can I finish my story?
Yeah, of course.
She says, no way. We're going to make our own life. We're going to leave. We're going to create our own life. And at that particular moment, Fizzy comes back from a night away. And Fizzy, throughout the film, all he ever wants is a bubble machine. You know those little machines that kind of blow bubbles? And he arrives and bubbles float across the screen. He's got his bubble machine, but we know where he got his bubble machine because he'd been renting himself out.
Aww.
So it's a duality. Anyway, Minnie and Noah says to Fizzy, do you want to come? Let's be a family. We'll go away and we'll invent our own life. So he says, yeah, I'll come with you. So they all go off and they enter this place called the Bristol Suspension Bridge, which is a very famous. The other side of Bristol Suspension Bridge is like another land. So symbolically, it's mm-hmm. their new world. And at that point, Fizz says, I can't come. I've got to go back to my mum. She needs me.
Aww.
Because he has a home there, actually. Even though they have this dysfunctional life, they have a real relationship. So he goes back to what is actually a home. And the duality of the suspension bridge is that on the other side is the world, the new world, but it's also a place where people commit suicide.
Oh, so you don't know. So if you know, you know.
So what is their home?
Yeah, what is their future? Wow, it makes you think. It really does.
We've run out of time.
I know. And that is all the time that we have for today. But Mark, is there any final thought that you'd like to leave the audience with?
Follow your passion and make it happen.
I love it. I'm so excited. I want to see Home now. I want to see the big dance battle. So
yeah, really. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's been gestating for so long. And now is the time. Look, I've just delivered, you know, two big franchises, The Witcher and... One Piece, and I got to get back to that kind of really grassroots passion.
Yeah,
where there's not you're not doing it for
your
the money, you're
your
doing
own
it
fire.
For the collaboration and the sweat and the blood and the tears, and you know that's going to come with it, but you know that it's going to be really heartfelt.
Thank you, Mark, for coming on the show. If you'd like to keep up with Mark, you can check him out on his website, markjobst.com. That is markjobst.com. I'm Gala Avery, and this has been The Gala Show. The Gala Show is brought to you by Insertomatic. This episode was executive produced by Roger Avery and produced by Gala Avery. Music composed by Andy Milburn. As always, I'm your host, Gala Avery. Copyright 2023, all rights reserved. Despite me sharing the same last name with this charity, I don't have any affiliation with it, besides the fact the issue is very near and dear to my heart. Did you know that in the United States, 2.7 million children currently have a parent in prison, and it's estimated that 10 million children have experienced parental incarceration at some point in their lives? I was one of these kids, and as an adult, I am really grateful to be able to give back to Project Avery. Their mission is to build leadership from within by supporting community through programs such as mentoring and outdoor education, and also to remove the stigma surrounding having a parent that's incarcerated. you don't have to feel alone. If you know a kid who could use these resources or would like to donate money or time to the charity, please go to Project Avery, that's AVARY.org, to check out what this amazing charity is all about. Again, that's ProjectAvery.org. Thank you guys from the bottom of my heart.